Chapter 57. Interlude. The Parts That Form Us. Moving slowly, Bast stretched and looked around the room. Finally, the short fuse of his patience burned out.
Reshi?
Hmm?
Quoth looked at him.
And then what, Reshi? Did you talk to her?
Of course I talked to her. There would be no story if I hadn't. Telling that part is easy. But first, I must describe her. I'm not sure how to do it.
Bast fidgeted. Quoth laughed, a fond expression wiping the irritation from his face.
So, is describing a beautiful woman as easy as looking at one for you?
Bast looked down and blushed, and Quoth laid a gentle hand on his arm, smiling.
My trouble, Bast, is that she is very important. Important to the story. I cannot think of how to describe her without falling short of the mark.
I think I understand, Reshi,
Bast said in conciliatory tones. I've seen her, too. Once. Quoth sat back in his chair, surprised.
You have, haven't you?
I'd forgotten. He pressed his hands to his lips.
How would you describe her, then?
Bast brightened at the opportunity. Straightening up in his chair, he looked thoughtful for a moment, and then said,
She had perfect ears.
He made a delicate gesture with his hands.
Perfect little ears, like they were carved out of something.
Chronicler laughed, then looked slightly taken aback, as if he'd surprised himself.
Her ears?
He asked, as if he couldn't be sure if he had heard correctly.
You know how hard it is to find a pretty girl with the right sort of ears,
Bast said matter-of-factly. Chronicler laughed again, seeming to find it easier the second time.
No, he said. No, I'm sure I don't.
Bast gave the story collector a deeply pitying look.
Well, then, you'll just have to take my word for it. They were exceptionally fine.
I think you've struck that chord well enough, Bast, Quoth said, amused. He paused for a moment, and when he spoke again, it was slowly, his eyes far away.
The trouble is, she is unlike anyone I have ever known. There was something intangible about her, something compelling, like heat from a fire. She had a grace, a spark.
She had a crooked nose, Reshi,
Bast said, interrupting his master's reverie. Quoth looked at him, a line of irritation creasing his forehead.
What?
Bast held his hands up defensively.
It's just something I noticed, Reshi. All the women in your story are beautiful. I can't gainsay you as a whole, as I've never seen any of them, but this one I did see. Her nose was a little crooked, and if we're being honest here, her face was a little narrow for my taste. She wasn't a perfect beauty by any means, Reshi. I should know. I've made some study of these things.
Quoth stared at his student for a long moment, his expression solemn.
We are more than the parts that form us, Bast, he said with a hint of reproach.
I'm not saying she wasn't lovely, Reshi, Bast said quickly. She smiled at me. It had a sort of... It went right down into you, if you understand me.
I understand, Bast. But then again, I've met her.
Quoth looked at Chronicler.
The trouble comes from comparison, you see. If I say she was dark-haired, you might think, I've known dark-haired women, some of them lovely. But you would be far off the mark, because that woman would not really have anything in common with her. That other woman wouldn't have her quick wit, her easy charm. She was unlike anyone I have ever met.
Quoth trailed off, looking down at folded hands. He was quiet for such a long moment that Bast began to fidget, looking around anxiously.
There's no sense worrying, I suppose,
Quoth said at last, looking up and motioning to Chronicler.
If I ruin this as well, it'll be a small thing as far as the world is concerned.
Chronicler picked up his pen, and Quoth began to speak before he had the chance to dip it.
Her eyes were dark. Dark as chocolate, dark as coffee, dark as the polished wood of my father's lute. They were set in a fair face, oval, like a teardrop. Kvothe stopped suddenly, as if he had run himself out of words. The silence was so sudden and deep the chronicler glanced briefly up from his page, something he had not done before. But even as chronicler looked up, another flood of words burst out of Kvothe. Her easy smile could stop a man's heart. Her lips were red, not the garish painted red so many women believe makes them desirable. Her lips were always red, morning and night, as if minutes before you saw her she had been eating sweet berries or drinking heart's blood. No matter where she stood, she was in the center of the room. Kvothe frowned. Do not misunderstand. She was not loud or vain. We stare at a fire because it flickers, because it glows. The light is what catches our eyes. But what makes a man lean close to a fire has nothing to do with its bright shape. What draws you to a fire is the warmth you feel when you come near. The same was true of Denna. As Kvothe spoke, his expression twisted, as if each word he spoke rankled him more and more. And while the words were clear, they matched his expression, as if each one was rasped with a rough file before it left his mouth. She... Kvothe's head was bowed so low, he seemed to be speaking to his hands laying in his lap. What am I doing? He said faintly, as if his mouth was full of gray ash. What good can come of this? How can I make any sense of her for you when I have never understood the least piece of her myself? Chronicler had written most of this out before he realized that Kvothe had probably not intended him to. He froze for a bare moment, then finished scratching down the rest of the sentence. Then he waited a long, quiet moment before he stole a look upward at Kvothe. Kvothe's eyes caught and held him. They were the same dark eyes that Chronicler had seen before. Eyes like an angry god's. For a moment, it was all Chronicler could do not to draw back from the table. There was an icy silence. Kvothe stood and pointed at the paper that lay in front of Chronicler. Cross that out, he grated. Chronicler blanched, his expression as stricken as if he'd been stabbed. When he made no move, Kvothe reached down and calmly slid the half-written sheet from under Chronicler's pen. If crossing out is something you feel disinclined toward, Kvothe tore the half-written sheet with slow care, the sound bleeding the color from Chronicler's face. With terrible deliberateness, Kvothe lifted a blank sheet and lay it carefully in front of the stunned scribe. One long finger stabbed at the torn sheet, smearing the still wet ink. Copy to here, he said in a voice that was cold and motionless as iron. The iron was in his eyes, too, hard and dark. There was no arguing. Chronicler quietly copied to where Kvothe's finger pinned the paper to the table. Once Chronicler was finished, Kvothe began to speak crisply and clearly, as if he were biting off pieces of ice. In what manner was she beautiful? I realize that I cannot say enough. So, since I cannot say enough, at least I will avoid saying too much. Say this, that she was dark-haired. There. It was long and straight. She was dark of eye and fair complected. There. Her face was oval. Her jaw strong and delicate. Say that she was poised and graceful. There. Kvothe took a breath before continuing. Finally, say that she was beautiful. That is all that can be well said. That she was beautiful, through to her bones, despite any flaw or fault. She was beautiful to Kvothe, at least. At least? To Kvothe, she was most beautiful. For a moment, Kvothe tensed as if he would leap up and tear this sheet away from Chronicler as well. Then he relaxed, like a sail when the wind leaves it. But to be honest, it must be said that she was beautiful to others as well. Chapter 58. Names for Beginning. It would be nice to say that our eyes met and I moved smoothly to her side. It would be nice to say that I smiled and spoke of pleasant things in carefully metered rhyming couplets, like Prince Gallant from some fairy story. Unfortunately, life is seldom so carefully scripted. In truth, I simply stood. It was Denna, the young woman I had met in Rowan's caravan so long ago. Come to think of it, it had only been half a year. Not so long when you're listening to a story, but half a year is a great long while to live through, especially if you are young. And we were both of us very young. I caught sight of Denna as she was climbing the final step onto the third level of the Aeolian. Her eyes were downcast, her expression thoughtful, almost sad. She turned and began to walk in my direction without lifting her eyes from the floor, without seeing me. The months had changed her. Where before she had been pretty, now she was lovely as well. Perhaps that difference was only that she wasn't wearing the road clothes I had met her in, but a long dress instead. But it was Denna, without a doubt. I even recognized the ring on her finger, silver, set with a pale blue stone. Since we parted ways, I had kept foolish, fond thoughts of Denna hidden in a secret corner of my heart. I had thought of making the trip to Annalyn and tracking her down, of meeting her by chance on the road again, of her coming to find me at the university. But deep down, I knew these thoughts for nothing more than childish daydreams. I knew the truth. I would never see her again. But here she was, and I was entirely unprepared. Would she even remember me, the awkward boy she had known for a few days so long ago? Denna was barely a dozen feet away when she looked up and saw me. Her expression brightened, as if someone had lit a candle inside her and she was glowing from its light. She rushed toward me, closing the distance between us in three excited skipping steps. For a moment, she looked as if she would run straight into my arms, but at the last moment she pulled back, darting a glance at the people sitting around us. In the space of half a step, she transformed her delighted, headlong run into a demure greeting at arm's length. It was gracefully done, but even so, she had to reach out a hand and steady herself against my chest, lest she stumble into me due to her sudden stop. She smiled at me then. It was warm and sweet and shy, like a flower unfurling. It was friendly and honest and slightly embarrassed. When she smiled at me, I felt... I honestly cannot think of how I could describe it. Lying would be easier. I could steal from 100 stories and tell you a lie so familiar you would swallow it whole. I could say my knees went to rubber, that my breath came hard in my chest. But that would not be the truth. My heart did not pound or stop or stutter. That is the sort of thing they say happens in stories. Foolishness, hyperbole, tripe, but still. Go out in the early days of winter, after the first cold snap of the season. Find a pool of water with a sheet of ice across the top, still fresh and new and clear as glass. Near the shore, the ice will hold you. Slide out farther, farther. Eventually, you'll find the place where the surface just barely bears your weight. There, you will feel what I felt. The ice splinters under your feet. Look down, and you can see the white cracks darting through the ice like mad, elaborate spiderwebs. It is perfectly silent, but you can feel the sudden sharp vibrations through the bottoms of your feet. That is what happened when Denna smiled at me. I don't mean to imply I felt as if I stood on brittle ice about to give way beneath me. No. I felt like the ice itself, suddenly shattered, with cracks spiraling out from where she had touched my chest. The only reason I held together was because my 1,000 pieces were all leaning together. If I moved, I feared I would fall apart. Perhaps it is enough to say that I was caught by a smile. And though that sounds as if it came from a storybook, it is very near the truth. Words have never been difficult for me. Quite the opposite, in fact. Often I find it all too easy to speak my mind, and things go badly because of it. However, here, in front of Denna, I was too stunned to speak. I could not have said a sensible word to save my life. Without thinking, all the courtly manners my mother had drilled into me came to the fore. I reached out smoothly and clasped Denna's outstretched hand in my own, as if she offered it to me. Then I took a half step backward and made a genteel three-quarter bow. At the same time, my free hand caught hold of the edge of my cloak and tucked it behind my back. It was a flattering bow, courtly without being ridiculously formal, and safe for a public setting such as this. What next? A kiss on the hand was traditional, but what sort of kiss was appropriate? In a tour, you merely nod over the hand. Sealdish ladies, like the moneylender's daughter I had chatted with earlier, expect you to brush the knuckles lightly and make a kissing sound. In Modeg, you actually press your lips to the back of your own thumb. But we were in Commonwealth, and Denna showed no foreign accent. A straightforward kiss, then. I pressed my lips gently to the back of her hand for the space of time it takes to draw a quick breath. Her skin was warm and smelled vaguely of heather. "I'm at your service, my lady," I said, standing and releasing her hand. For the first time in my life, I understood the true purpose of this sort of formal greeting. It gives you a script to follow when you have absolutely no idea what to say. "My lady?" Denna echoed, sounding a little surprised. "Very well, if you insist." She took hold of her dress with one hand and bobbed a curtsy, somehow managing to make it look graceful and mocking and playful all at once. "Your lady?" Hearing her voice, I knew my suspicions were true. She was my Eloine. "What are you doing up here in the third circle alone?" She glanced around the crescent-shaped balcony. "Are you alone?" "I was alone," I said. Then, when I could think of nothing else to say, I borrowed a line from the song fresh in my memory. "Now unexpected, Eloine beside me stands." She smiled at that, flattered. "How do you mean unexpected?" she asked. "I had more than half convinced myself that you had already left." "It was a near thing," Denna said archly. 2 hours I waited for my Savian to come." She sighed tragically, glancing up and to one side like a statue of a saint. "Finally, filled with despair, I decided Eloine could do the finding this time, and damn the story." She smiled a wicked smile. "So, we were ill-lit ships at night," I quoted. "Passing close, but all unknown to one another," Denna finished. "Felward's falling," I said with something that touched the outward boundary of respect. "Not many people know that play." "I am not many people," she said. "I will never forget that again." I bowed my head with exaggerated deference. She snorted derisively. I ignored it and continued in a more serious tone. "I can't thank you enough for helping me tonight." "You can't?" she said. "Well, that's a shame. How much can you thank me?" Without thinking, I reached up to the collar of my cloak and unpinned my talent pipes. "Only this much," I said, holding them out to her. Denna hesitated, somewhat taken aback. "You can't be serious." "Without you, I wouldn't have won them," I said. "And I have nothing else of any value unless you want my loot." Denna's dark eyes studied my face as if she couldn't decide if I was making fun or not. "I don't think you can give away your pipes." "I can, actually," I said. "Stanchion mentioned if I lost them or gave them away, I'd have to earn another set." I took her hand, uncurled her fingers, then laid the silver pipes on her palm. "That means I can do with them as I please, and it pleases me to give them to you." Denna stared at the pipes in her hand, then looked at me with deliberate attention, as if she hadn't entirely noticed me before. For a moment, I was painfully aware of my appearance. My cloak was threadbare, and even wearing my best clothes, I was a short step from shabby. She looked down again and slowly closed her hand around the pipes. Then she looked up at me, her expression unreadable. "I think you might be a wonderful person," she said. I drew a breath, but Denna spoke first. "However," she said, "this is too great a thanks. More payment than is appropriate for any help I've given you. I would end up in your debt." She caught hold of my hand and pressed the pipes back into it. I would rather have you beholden to me.
She grinned suddenly.
This way, you still owe me a favor.
The room grew noticeably quieter. I looked around, confused due to the fact that I'd forgotten where I was. Denna lay a finger to her lips and pointed over the railing to the stage below. We stepped closer to the edge and looked down to see an old man with a white beard opening an oddly shaped instrument case. I sucked in a surprised breath when I saw what he was holding.
"What is that thing?"
Denna asked.
"It's an old court lute," I said, unable to keep the amazement out of my voice. "I've never actually seen one before."
"That's a lute?" Denna's lips moved silently.
"I count 24 strings. How does that even work? That's more than some harps."
"That's how they made them years ago, before metal strings, before they knew how to brace a long neck. It's incredible. There's more careful engineering in that swan neck than in any three cathedrals."
I watched as the old man tucked his beard out of the way and adjusted himself in his seat.
"I just hope he tuned it before he went on stage," I added softly. "Otherwise, we'll be waiting an hour while he fiddles with his pegs. My father used to say the old minstrels used to spend 2 days stringing and 2 hours of tuning to get 2 minutes music from an old court lute."
It only took the old man about 5 minutes to get the strings in agreement. Then he began to play. I am ashamed to admit it, but I remember nothing of the song. Despite the fact that I had never seen a court lute, let alone heard one, my mind was too awhirl with thoughts of Denna to absorb much else. As we leaned on the railing side by side, I snuck glances of her out of the corner of my eye. She hadn't called me by name, or mentioned our meeting before in Rowan's caravan. That meant she didn't remember me. Not too surprising, I suppose, that she would forget a ragged boy she'd only known for a few days on the road. Still, it stung a bit, as I'd had fond thoughts of her for months. Still, there was no way to bring it up now without seeming foolish. Better to make a fresh start and hope I was more memorable the second time around. The song was over before I realized it, and I clapped enthusiastically to make up for my inattention.
"I thought you'd made a mistake when you doubled your chorus earlier," Denna said to me as the applause died down. "I couldn't believe you really wanted a stranger to join in. I haven't seen that done anywhere except around campfires at night."
I shrugged. Everyone kept telling me this is where the best musicians played. I made a sweeping gesture with one hand toward her. I trusted someone would know the part.
She arched an eyebrow. "It was a near thing," she said. "I waited for someone else to jump in instead. I was a little anxious to step in myself." I gave her a puzzled look.
"Why? You have a lovely voice."
She gave a sheepish grimace.
"I'd only heard the song twice before this. I wasn't sure if I'd remember all of it."
"Twice?"
Denna nodded. "And the second time was just a span ago. A couple played it during a formal dinner I attended off in Aetnia."
"Are you serious?" I said incredulously.
She tilted her head back and forth, as if caught in a white lie. Her dark hair fell across her face, and she brushed it away absent-mindedly.
"Okay, I suppose I did hear the couple rehearse a little right before the dinner."
I shook my head, hardly believing it.
"That's amazing. It's a terribly difficult harmony, and to remember all the lyrics?"
I marveled silently for a moment, shaking my head.
"You have an incredible ear."
"You're not the first man to say that," Denna said wryly, "but you might be the first to say it while actually looking at my ears."
She glanced down meaningfully. I felt myself beginning to blush furiously when I heard a familiar voice behind us.
"There you are!"
Turning, I saw Savoy, my tall, handsome friend and co-conspirator from Advanced Sympathy.
"Here I am,"
I said, surprised that he would seek me out, doubly surprised that he would have the bad grace to interrupt me when I was in a private conversation with a young woman.
"Here we all are!"
Savoy smiled at me as he walked over and put his arm casually around Denna's waist. He made a mock frown at her. I scour the bottom levels trying to help you find your singer, while all the while both of you are up here, thick as thieves.
We stumbled into each other, Denna said, laying her hand over his where it rested on her hip. I knew you'd come back for your drink, if nothing else.
She nodded to a nearby table, empty except for a pair of wine glasses. Together they turned and walked arm in arm back to their table. Denna looked over her shoulder at me and gave a sort of shrug with her eyebrows. I hadn't the slightest idea what the expression meant.
Savoy waved me over to join them and pulled over an unoccupied chair so I would have a place to sit.
I couldn't quite believe it was you down there, he said to me. I thought I recognized your voice, but...
He gestured, indicating the highest level of the Aeolian.
While the third circle provides a comfortable privacy for young lovers, its view of the stage leaves a little to be desired. I didn't know you played.
He settled a long arm across Denna's shoulders and smiled his charming blue-eyed smile.
Off and on, I said flippantly as I sat down.
Lucky for you, I picked the Aeolian for our entertainment tonight, Savoy said. Otherwise, you've had nothing but echoes and crickets to accompany you.
Then I'm in your debt, I said to him with a deferential nod.
Make it up to me by taking Simon as a partner next time we play corners, he said. That way you're the one to eat the forfeit when the giddy little bastard calls the tall card with nothing but a pair.
Done, I said. Though it pains me. I turned to Denna. What of you? I owe you a great favor. How can I repay it? Ask anything and it's yours, should it be within my skill.
Anything within your skill? She repeated playfully. What can you do then, besides play so well that Talu and his angels would weep to hear?
I imagine I could do anything, I said easily, if you would ask it of me.
She laughed.
That's a dangerous thing to say to a woman, Savoy said. Especially this one. She'll have you off to bring her a leaf of the singing tree from the other side of the world.
She leaned back in her chair and looked at me with dangerous eyes. A leaf of the singing tree, she mused. That might be a nice thing to have. Would you bring me one?
I would, I said, and was surprised to find that it was the truth.
She seemed to consider it, then shook her head playfully. I couldn't send you journeying so far away. I'll have to save my favor for another day. I sighed.
So I'm left in your debt.
Oh, no! She exclaimed. Another weight upon my Savian's heart.
The reason my heart is so heavy is that I fear I might never know your name. I could keep thinking of you as Felurian, I said, but that could lead to unfortunate confusion.
She gave me an appraising look.
Felurian? I might like that if I didn't think you were a liar.
A liar? I said indignantly. My first thought in seeing you was Felurian. What have I done? The adulation of my peers below has been a waste of hours. Could I recall the moments I have careless cast away, I could but hope to spend them in a wiser way, and warm myself in light that rivals light of day.
She smiled.
A thief and a liar. You stole that from the third act of Deonica.
She knew Deonica, too.
Guilty, I admitted freely, but that doesn't make it untrue.
She smiled at Savoy, and then turned back to me.
Flattery is fine and good, but it won't win you my name. Savoy mentioned you were keeping pace with him at the university. That means you meddle with dark forces better left alone. If I give you my name, you would have a terrible power over me.
Her mouth was serious, but her smile showed itself around the corners of her eyes, in the tilt of her head.
That is very true, I said with equal seriousness, but I will make you a bargain. I'll give you my name in exchange. Then I will be in your power as well.
You'd sell me my own shirt, she said. Savoy knows your name. Assuming he hasn't told me already, I could have it from him as easy as breathing.
True enough, Savoy said, seeming relieved that we remembered he was there.
He took up her hand and kissed the back of it.
"He can tell you my name," I said dismissively, "but he cannot give it to you. Only I can do that."
I lay one hand flat on the table. "My offer stands, my name for yours. Will you take it? Or will I be forced to think of you always as an Eloine, and never as yourself?"
Her eyes danced.
"Very well," she said. "I'll have yours first, though."
I leaned forward and motioned for her to do the same. She let go of Sovoy's hand and turned an ear toward me. With due solemnity, I whispered my name in her ear.
Kvolf.
She smelled faintly of flowers, which I guessed was a perfume. But beneath that was her own smell, like green grass, like the open road after a light spring rain. Then she leaned back into her seat and seemed to think of it for a while.
Kvolf, she said eventually. "It suits you. Kvolf."
Her eyes sparkled as if she held some hidden secret. She said it slowly, as if tasting it, then nodded to herself.
"What does it mean?"
"It means many things," I said in my best Taberlin the Great voice. "But you will not distract me so easily. I have paid, and now I am in your power. Would you give me your name that I might call you by it?" She smiled and leaned forward again. I did likewise. Turning my head to the side, I felt an errant strand of her hair brush against me.
"Diane."
Her warm breath was like a feather against my ear.
"Diane."
We both sat back in our seats. When I didn't say anything, she prompted me.
"Well?"
"I have it," I assured her, "as sure as I know my own."
"Say it, then."
"I'm saving it," I reassured her, smiling. "Gifts like these should not be squandered." She looked at me. I relented.
"Diane,"
I said.
"Diane, it suits you as well."
We looked at each other for a long moment. Then I noticed that Sovoy was giving me a not quite subtle stare. "I should get back downstairs," I said, rising quickly from my seat. "I've got important people to meet." I cringed inwardly at the awkwardness of the words as soon as I'd said them, but couldn't think of a less awkward way to take them back. Sovoy stood and shook my hand, no doubt eager to be rid of me.
"Well done tonight, Kvolf. I'll be seeing you."
I turned to see Denna standing too. She met my eyes and smiled.
"I hope to see you too."
She held out her hand. I gave her my best smile. "There's always hope." I meant it to seem witty, but the words seemed to turn boorish as soon as they left my mouth. I had to leave before I made an even greater ass of myself. I shook her hand quickly. It was slightly cool to the touch. Soft, delicate, and strong. I did not kiss it, as Sovoy was my friend, and that is not the sort of thing friends do. Chapter 59. All This Knowing. In the fullness of time, and with considerable help from Diak and Willem, I became drunk. Thus it was that three students made their slightly erratic way back to the university. See them as they go, weaving only slightly. It is quiet, and when the belling tower strikes the late hour, it doesn't break the silence so much as it underpins it. The crickets, too, respect the silence. Their calls are like careful stitches in its fabric, almost too small to be seen. The night is like warm velvet around them. The stars, burning diamonds in the cloudless sky, turn the road beneath their feet a silver gray. The university and Imre are the hearts of understanding and art, the strongest of the four corners of civilization. Here on the road between the two, there is nothing but old trees and long grass bending to the wind. The night is perfect in a wild way, almost terrifyingly beautiful. The three boys, one dark, one light, and one, for lack of a better word, fiery, do not notice the night. Perhaps some part of them does, but they are young and drunk and busy knowing deep in their hearts that they will never grow old or die.
They also know that they are friends, and they share a certain love that will never leave them. The boys know many other things, but none of them seem as important as this. Perhaps they are right. Chapter 60. Fortune. The next day I went to the admissions lottery, sporting my very first hangover. Weary and vaguely nauseous, I joined the shortest line and tried to ignore the din of hundreds of students milling about, buying, selling, trading, and generally complaining about the slots they'd drawn for their exams. "Quoth, Ardalan's son," I said when I finally arrived at the front of the line. The bored-looking woman marked my name, and I drew a tile out of the black velvet bag. It read, "Hepton, noon. 5 days from now. Plenty of time to prepare." But as I turned back to the mews, a thought occurred to me. How much preparation did I really need? More importantly, how much could I genuinely accomplish without access to the archives? Thinking it over, I raised my hand over my head with my middle finger and thumb extended, signaling that I had a slot 5 days from now that I was willing to sell. It wasn't long before an unfamiliar student wandered close. "Fourth day," she said, holding up her own tile. "I'll give you a jot to trade." I shook my head. She shrugged and wandered away. Galvin, a Raylar from the Medica, approached me. He held up his index finger, indicating that he had a slot later this afternoon. From the circles under his eyes and his anxious expression, I didn't think he was eager to go through testing that soon.
"Will you take 5 jots?
"I'd like to get a whole talent." He nodded, flipping his own tile over between his fingers. It was a fair price. No one wanted to go through admissions on the first day.
"Maybe later. I'll look around a little first."
As I watched him leave, I marveled at the difference a single day could make. Yesterday, 5 jots would have seemed like all the money in the world. But today, my purse was heavy. I was lost in vague musings about how much money I had actually earned last night when I saw Willem and Simon approaching. Will looked a little pale under his dark sealedish complexion. I guessed he was feeling the after effects of our night's carousing, too. Sim, on the other hand, was bright and sunny as ever. "Guess who drew slots this afternoon?" He nodded over my shoulder. "Ambrose and several of his friends. It's enough to make me believe in a just universe." Turning to search the crowd, I heard Ambrose's voice before I saw him. "From the same bag. That means they did a piss-poor job mixing. They should restart this whole mismanaged sham and..." Ambrose was walking with several well-dressed friends, their eyes sweeping over the crowd, looking for raised hands. Ambrose was a dozen feet away before he finally looked down and realized the hand he was heading toward was mine. He stopped short, scowling, then gave a sudden barking laugh. "You poor boy! All the time in the world and no way to spend it! Hasn't Lauren let you back in yet?"
"Hammer and horn,"
Will said wearily behind me. Ambrose smiled at me. "Tell you what, I'll give you halfpenny and one of my old shirts for your slot. That way you'll have something to wear when you're washing that one in the river." A few of his friends chuckled behind him, looking me up and down. I kept my expression nonchalant, not wanting to give him any satisfaction. Truth was, I was all too aware of the fact that I only owned 2 shirts, and after 2 terms of constant wear, they were getting shabby. Shabbier. What's more, I did wash them in the river, as I'd never had money to spare for laundry. "I'll pass," I said lightly. "Your shirt tails are a little richly dyed for my taste." I tugged at the front of my own shirt to make my point clear. A few nearby students laughed. "I don't get it," I heard Sim say quietly to Will.
"He's implying Ambrose has the..."
Will paused.
"The edematetes, a disease you get from whores. There's a discharge..."
"Okay, okay," Sim said quickly. "I get it, ick. Ambrose is wearing green, too." Meanwhile, Ambrose forced himself to chuckle along with the crowd at my joke. "I suppose I deserve that," he said. "Very well. Pennies for the poor." He brought out his purse and shook it. "How much do you want?" 5 talents, I said. He stared at me, frozen in the act of opening his purse. It was an outrageous price. A few of the spectators nudged each other with their elbows, obviously hoping I'd somehow swindle Ambrose into paying several times what my slot was actually worth. "I'm sorry," I asked. "Do you need that converted?" It was a well-known fact that Ambrose had botched the arithmetic portion of his admissions last term. "Five is ridiculous," he said. "You'd be lucky to get one this late in the day." I forced a careless shrug. "I'd settle for four." "You'll settle for one," Ambrose insisted. "I'm not an idiot." I took a deep breath, let it out again, resigned. "I don't suppose I could get you to go as high as 1 and 4? I asked, disgusted by how plaintive my voice sounded. Ambrose smiled like a shark. "I tell you what," he said magnanimously. "I'll give you 1 and 3. I'm not above a little charity now and again." "Thank you, sir," I said meekly. "It's much appreciated." I could sense the crowd's disappointment as I rolled over like a dog for Ambrose's money. "Don't mention it," Ambrose said smugly. "Always a pleasure to help out the needy. In vintage coin, that'll be 2 nobles, 6 bits, 2 pennies, and 4 shims. "I can do my own conversions," he snapped. "I've traveled the world with my father's retinue since I was a boy. I know how money spends." "Of course you do," I ducked my head. "Silly of me." I looked up curiously. "You've been to Modeg, then?" "Of course," he said absent-mindedly, as he proceeded to dig through his purse, pulling out an assortment of coins. "I've actually been to High Court in Kershane, 2. "Is it true that the Modegan nobility regard haggling as a contemptible activity for those of any high-born station?" I asked innocently. "I heard that they consider it a sure sign that the person is either possessed of low blood or fallen on truly desperate times." Ambrose looked up at me, frozen halfway through the act of digging coins out of his purse. His eyes narrowed. "Because if that's true, it's terribly kind of you to come down to my level just for the fun of a little bargain." I grinned at him. "We rue love to dicker." There was a murmur of laughter from the crowd around us. It had grown to several dozen people at this point. "That's not it at all," Ambrose said. My face became a mask of concern. "Oh, I'm sorry, my lord. I had no idea you'd come on hard times." I took several steps toward him, holding out my admissions tile. "Here, you can have it for just a halfpenny. I'm not above a little charity myself." I stood directly in front of him, holding out the tile. "Please, I insist. It's always a pleasure to help the needy." Ambrose glared furiously. "Keep it and choke," he hissed at me in a low voice. "And remember this when you're eating beans and washing in the river. I'll still be here the day you leave with nothing but your hands in your pockets." He turned and left, the very picture of affronted dignity. There was a smattering of applause from the surrounding crowd. I took flourishing bows in all directions.
"How would you score that one?" Will asked Sim.
2 for Ambrose, 3 for Quoth. Sim looked at me. "Not your best work, really." "I didn't get much sleep last night," I admitted.
"Every time you do this, it makes the eventual payback that much worse," Will said.
"We can't do anything but snap at each other," I said. "The masters made sure of that. Anything too extreme would get us expelled for conduct unbecoming of a member of the Arcanum. Why do you think I haven't made his life a hell?"
"You're lazy," Will suggested.
"Laziness is one of my best characteristics," I said easily. "If I weren't lazy, I might go through the work of translating Edamate Tas and grow terribly offended when I discover it means the edema drip." I raised my hand again, thumb and middle finger extended. "Instead, I'll assume it translates directly into the name of the disease, Nemseria, thus preventing any unnecessary strain on our friendship." I eventually sold my slot to a desperate Raelar from the fishery named Jaxim. I drove a hard bargain, trading him my slot for 6 jots and a favor to be named later. Admissions went about as well as could be expected. considering I couldn't study. Hem was still carrying his grudge. Lauren was cool. Elodin had his head down on the table and seemed to be asleep. My tuition was a full 6 talents, which put me in an interesting situation. The long road to Imre was mostly deserted. The sun brushed through the trees, and the wind carried just a hint of the cool that fall would soon be bringing. I headed to the Aeolian first to retrieve my loot. Stanchion had insisted that I leave it there last night, lest I break it on my long, inebriated walk home. As I approached the Aeolian, I saw Diak lounging against the doorpost, walking a coin across the back knuckles of his hand. He smiled when he saw me.
"Hold there! Thought you and your friends would end up in the river by the way you were weaving when you left last night."
"We were swaying in different directions," I explained, "so it balanced out." Diak laughed.
"We've got your lady inside."
I fought down a flush and wondered how he had known I was hoping to find Denna here. "I don't know if I would call her my lady, exactly. Savoy was my friend, after all."
He shrugged. "Whatever you call her, Stanchion's got her behind the bar. I'd go grab her before he gets overly familiar and starts practicing his fingering."
I felt a flash of rage and barely managed to swallow a mouthful of hot words. My loot. He was talking about my loot. I ducked inside quickly, guessing the less Diak saw of my expression, the better it would be. I wandered through the 3 levels of the Aeolian, but Denna was nowhere to be found. I did run into Count Threp, though, who enthusiastically invited me to have a seat.
"I don't suppose I might persuade you to pay me a visit at my house sometime?"
Threp asked bashfully.
"I'm thinking of having a little dinner, and I know a few people who would love to meet you."
He winked.
"Word about your performance is already getting around."
I felt a twinge of anxiety, but I knew rubbing elbows with the nobility was something of a necessary evil. "I'd be honored to, my lord." Threp grimaced.
"Does it have to be, my lord?"
Diplomacy is a large part of being a trooper, and a large portion of diplomacy is adherence to title and rank. "Etiquette, my lord," I said regretfully.
"Piss on etiquette,"
Threp said petulantly.
"Etiquette is a set of rules people use so they can be rude to each other in public. I was born Danaeus first, Threp second, and Count last of all."
He looked imploringly up at me.
"Den for short?"
I hesitated.
"Here, at least," he pleaded. "It makes me feel like a weed in a flower bed when someone starts lording me here."
I relaxed. "If it makes you happy, Den." He flushed as if I'd flattered him.
"Tell me a bit about yourself, then. Where are you lodging?"
"On the other side of the river," I said evasively. The bunks in Mews were not exactly glamorous. When Threp gave me a puzzled look, I continued. "I attend the university."
"The university?"
he asked, clearly puzzled.
"Are they teaching music now?"
I almost laughed at the thought. "No, no. I'm in the Arcanum." I immediately regretted my words. He leaned back in his seat and gave me an uncomfortable look.
"You're a warlock."
"Oh, no," I said dismissively. "I'm just studying. You know, grammar, mathematics." I picked 2 of the more innocent fields of study I could think of, and he seemed to relax a bit.
"I guess I just thought you were..."
He trailed off and shook himself.
"Why are you studying there?"
The question caught me off guard. I've always wanted to. There's so much to learn."
"But you don't need any of that. I mean,"
he groped for words,
"the way you play. Surely your patron is encouraging you to focus on your music."
"I don't have a patron, Den," I said with a shy smile. "Not that I'm opposed to the idea, mind you." His reaction was not what I expected.
"Damn my blackened luck."
He slapped his hand on the table, hard.
"I assumed someone was being coy, keeping you a secret."
He thumped the table with his fist.
"Damn! Damn, damn!"
He recovered his composure a little and looked up at me.
"I'm sorry, it's just that..."
He made a frustrated gesture and sighed.
Have you ever heard the saying, one wife, you're happy, two, and you're tired?
I nodded. Three, and they'll hate each other.
Four, and they'll hate you,
Threp finished.
Well, the same thing is doubly true for patrons and their musicians. I just picked up my third, a struggling flutist.
He sighed and shook his head.
They bicker like cats in a bag, worried they're not getting enough attention. If only I'd known you were coming along, I would have waited.
You flatter me, Den.
I'm kicking myself is what I'm doing.
He sighed and looked guilty.
That's not fair. Saffron's good at what he does. They're all good musicians and overprotective of me, just like real wives.
He gave me an apologetic look.
If I try to bring you in, there'll be hell to pay. I've already had to lie about that little gift I gave you last night.
So I'm your mistress, then? I grinned. Threp chuckled.
Well, let's not carry the analogy too far. I'll be your matchmaker instead. I'll help you toward a proper patron. I know everyone with blood or money for 50 miles, so it shouldn't be that hard.
That would be a great help, I said earnestly. The social circles on this side of the river are a mystery to me. A thought occurred to me. Speaking of which, I met a young lady last night and didn't find out much about her. If you're familiar with the town... I trailed off, hopefully. He gave me a knowing look.
Ah, I see.
No, 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 I protested. She's the girl that sang along with me. My Eloine. I was just hoping to find her to pay my respects. Threp looked as if he didn't believe me, but wasn't going to make an issue of it.
Fair enough. What's her name?
Diane. Threp seemed to be waiting for more. That's all I know. Threp snorted.
What did she look like? Sing it if you have to.
I felt the beginning of a flush on my cheeks. She had dark hair to about here. I gestured a little lower than my shoulder with one hand. Young, fair skin. Threp watched me expectantly. Pretty.
I see,
Threp mused, rubbing his lips.
Did she have her talent pipes?
I don't know. Maybe.
Does she live in the city?
I shrugged my ignorance again, feeling more and more foolish. Threp laughed.
You're going to have to give me more than that.
He looked over my shoulder.
Wait, there's Diak. If anyone could spot a girl for you, it'd be him.
He raised his hand.
Diak!
It's really not that important, I said hurriedly. Threp ignored me and waved the broad-shouldered man over to our table. Diak strolled over and leaned against a table. What can I do for you?
Our young singer needs a little information about a lady that he met last night.
Can't say I'm surprised. There were quite a crop of lovelies out. One or two asked about you.
He winked at me.
Who caught your eye?
It's not like that, I protested. She was the one who sang my harmony last night. She had a lovely voice, and I was hoping to find her so we could do a little singing.
I think I know the tune you're talking about.
He gave me a broad, knowing smile. I felt myself blushing furiously and began to protest again.
Oh, settle down. I'll keep this one between my tongue and teeth. I'll even keep from telling Stanchion, which is as good as telling the whole town. He gossips like a schoolgirl when he's had a cup.
He looked at me expectantly. She was slender with deep, coffee-colored eyes, I said before I thought about how it sounded. I hurried on before either Threp or Diak could make a joke. Her name was Diane.
Ah!
Diak nodded slowly to himself, his smile going a little wry.
I guess I should have known.
Does she live here?
Threp asked.
I don't believe I know her.
You'd remember, Diak said. But no, I don't think she lives in town. I see her off and on. She travels, always here and gone again.
He rubbed the back of his head and gave me a worried smile.
I don't know where you might be able to find her. Careful, boy. That one will steal your heart. Men fall for her like wheat before a sickle blade.
I shrugged as if such things couldn't be further from my mind, and was glad when Threp turned the topic to a piece of gossip about one of the local councilmen. I chuckled at their bickering until my drink was done, then made my farewells and took my leave of them. Half an hour later, I stood on the stairway outside Debbie's door, trying to ignore the rancid smell of the butcher's shop below. I counted my money for the third time and thought about my options. I could pay off my entire debt and still afford my tuition, but it would leave me penniless. I had other debts to settle as well, and as much as I wanted to be out from under Debbie's thumb, I didn't relish starting the semester without a bit of coin in my pocket. The door opened suddenly, startling me. Debbie's face peered out suspiciously through a narrow crack, then brightened with a smile when she recognized me. "What are you lurking for?" she asked. "Gentlemen knock, as a rule." She opened the door wide to let me in. "Just weighing my options," I said as she bolted the door behind me. Her room was much the same as before, save that today it smelled of cinnamon, not lavender. "I hope I won't be inconveniencing you if I only pay the interest this term." "Not at all," she said graciously. "I like to think of it as an investment on my part." She gestured me toward a chair. "Besides, it means I get to see you again. You'd be surprised how few visitors I get." "It's probably your location more than your company," I said. She wrinkled her nose. "I know. I settled here at first because it was cheap. Now I feel obliged to stay because my customers know to find me here." I laid 2 talents on the desk and slid them toward her. "Do you mind a question?" She gave me a look of impish excitement. "Is it inappropriate?" "A bit," I admitted. "Has anyone ever tried to report you?" "Well, now," she sat forward in her chair, "that can be taken a number of different ways." She raised an eyebrow over one icy blue eye. "Are you being threatening or curious?" "Curious," I said quickly. "I tell you what," she nodded at my lute. "Play me a song, and I'll tell you the truth." I smiled and unlatched the case, drawing out my lute. "What would you like to hear?" She thought for a minute. "Can you play Leave the Town Tinker?" I played it, quick and easy. She came in enthusiastically on the chorus, and at the end she smiled and clapped like a young girl. Which, in hindsight, I guess she was. Back then, she was an older woman, experienced and self-sure. I, on the other hand, was not quite 16. "Once," she answered as I put my lute away. "2 years ago, a young gentleman, Elir, decided it would be better to inform the constable than to settle his debt." I looked up at her. "And?" "And that was it," she shrugged carelessly. "They came, asked me questions, searched the place. Didn't find anything incriminating, of course." "Of course." "The next day, the young gentleman admitted the truth to the constable. He had made the whole story up because I had spurned his romantic advances." She grinned. "The constable was not amused, and the gentleman was fined for slanderous action against a lady of the town." I couldn't help but smile. "I can't say as I'm terribly..." I trailed off, noticing something for the first time. I pointed at her bookshelf. "Is that Malkaff's The Basis of All Matter?" "Oh, yes," she said proudly. "It's new." "A partial repayment." She gestured toward the shelf. "Feel free." I walked over and pulled it out. "If I'd had this to study from, I wouldn't have missed one of the questions during admissions today." "I'd think you'd have your fill of books at the archives," she said, her voice thick with envy. I shook my head. "I was banned," I said. "I've spent about 2 hours total in the archives, and half of that was getting thrown out on my ear." Debbie nodded slowly. "I'd heard, but you never know which rumors are true. We're in something of the same boat, then." "I'd say you're slightly better off," I said, looking over her shelves. "You've got Tekum here, and the Hero Borica." I scanned all the titles, looking for anything that might have information about the Aemir or the Chandrian, but nothing looked especially promising. "You've got The Mating Habits of the Common Dracus, too. I was partway through reading that when I was kicked out."
"That's the latest edition," she said proudly. "There's new engravings and a section on the Fey and Moite." I ran my fingers down the book's spine, then stepped back. "It's a nice collection." "Well," she said teasingly, "if you promise to keep your hands clean, you could come over and do some reading now and again. If you bring your lute and play for me, I might even let you borrow a book or two, so long as you bring them back in a timely fashion." She gave me a winsome smile. "We exiles should stick together." I spent the long walk back to the university wondering if Devi was being flirtatious or friendly. At the end of the 3 miles, I hadn't reached anything resembling a decision. I mentioned this to make something clear. I was clever, a burgeoning hero with an ailer like a bar of Ramsden steel. But first and foremost, I was a 15-year-old boy. When it came to women, I was as lost as a lamb in the woods. I found Kilvin in his office, etching runes into a hemisphere of glass for another hanging lamp. I knocked softly on the open door. He glanced up at me.
"Ilir Kvoth, you are looking better?"
It took me a moment to remember that he was speaking of 3 span ago, when he banned me from my work at the fishery due to Willem's meddling. "Thank you, sir. I feel better." He cocked his head minutely. I lowered one hand to my purse. "I would like to resolve my debt to you." Kilvin grunted.
"You owe me nothing."
He looked back down at the table and the project in his hands. "My debt to the shop, then," I pressed. "I've been taking advantage of your good nature for some time now. How much do I owe for the materials I've used during my studies with Manette?" Kilvin continued to work.
1 talent, 7 jots, and 3.
The exactness of the number startled me, as he hadn't checked the ledger in the storeroom. I boggled to think of everything the bear-like man was carrying around in his head. I took the appropriate amount from my purse and set the coins on a relatively clutter-free corner of the table. Kilvin looked at them.
"Ilir Kvoth, I trust you came to this money honorably."
His tone was so serious, I had to smile. "I earned it playing in Imre last night."
"Music across the river pays this well?"
I held my smile and shrugged nonchalantly. "I don't know if I'll do this well every night. This was only my first time, after all." Kilvin made a sound somewhere between a snort and a huff and turned his eyes back to his work.
"Elxadal's pridefulness is rubbing off on you."
He drew a careful line on the glass.
"Am I correct in assuming that you will no longer be spending evenings in my employ?"
Shocked, it took me a moment to catch my breath. I wouldn't. I came here to speak with you about coming back to work in the shop." The thought of not working for Kilvin hadn't crossed my mind.
"Apparently your music has more profit than working here."
Kilvin gave the coins on the table a significant look. "But I want to work here," I said wretchedly. Kilvin's face broke into a great white smile.
"Good. I would not have wanted to lose you to the other side of the river. Music is a fine thing, but metal lasts."
He struck the table with 2 huge fingers to emphasize his point. Then he made a shooing motion with the hand that held his unfinished lamp.
"Go! Do not be late for work, or I will keep you polishing bottles and grinding ore for another term."
As I left, I thought about what Kilvin had said. It was the first thing he had said to me that I did not agree with wholeheartedly. Metal rusts, I thought. Music lasts forever. Time will eventually prove one of us right. After I left the fishery, I headed straight to the Horse and Four, arguably the best inn this side of the river. The innkeeper was a bald, portly fellow named Kaverin. I showed him my talent pipes and bargained for a pleasant 15 minutes. The end result was that in exchange for playing 3 evenings a span, I receive free room and board. The Four's kitchens were remarkable, and my room was actually a small suite. Bedroom, dressing room, and sitting room. A huge step up from my narrow bunk in the Mews. But best of all, I would earn 2 silver talents every month,
an almost ridiculous sum of money to someone who had been poor for as long as I had. And that was in addition to whatever gifts or tips the wealthy customers might give me. Playing here, working in the fishery, and with a wealthy patron on the horizon, I'd no longer be forced to live like a pauper. I'd be able to buy things I desperately needed. Another suit of clothes, some decent pens and paper, new shoes. If you have never been desperately poor, I doubt you can understand the relief I felt. For months, I'd been waiting for the other shoe to drop, knowing that any small catastrophe could ruin me. But now, I no longer had to live every day worrying about my next term's tuition or the interest on Devi's loan. I was no longer in danger of being forced out of the university. I had a lovely dinner of venison steak with a leaf salad and a bowl of delicately spiced tomato soup. There were fresh peaches and plums and white bread with sweet cream butter. Though I didn't even ask for it, I was served several glasses of an excellent dark vintage wine. Then I retired to my rooms where I slept like a dead man, lost in the vastness of my new feather bed. Chapter 61. Jackass, Jackass. With admissions behind me, I had no responsibilities until fall term began. I spent the intervening days catching up on my sleep, working in Kilvin's shop, and enjoying my new luxurious accommodations at the Horse and Four. I also spent a considerable amount of time on the road to Imre, usually under the excuse of visiting Threp or enjoying the camaraderie of the other musicians at the Aeolian. But the truth behind the stories was that I was hoping to find Denna. But my diligence gained me nothing. She seemed to have vanished from the town completely. I asked a few people who I could trust not to make gossip of it, but none of them knew more than Diak. I briefly entertained the thought of asking Savoy about her, but discarded it as a bad idea. After my sixth fruitless trip to Imre, I decided to abandon my search. After my ninth, I convinced myself it was a waste of valuable time. After my 14th trip, I came to the deep realization that I wouldn't find her. She was well and truly gone. Again. It was during one of my Denna-less trips to the Aeolian that I received some troubling news from Count Threp. Apparently, Ambrose, firstborn son of the wealthy and influential Baron Jackass, had been busy as a bee in the social circles of Imre. He had spread rumors, made threats, and generally turned the nobility against me. While he couldn't keep me from gaining the respect of my fellow musicians, apparently he could keep me from gaining a wealthy patron. It was my first glimpse of the trouble Ambrose could make for a person like me. Threp was apologetic and morose, while I seethed with irritation. Together we proceeded to drink an unwise amount of wine and grouse about Ambrose Jackass. Eventually, Threp was called up onto the stage where he sang a scathing little ditty of his own design, satirizing one of Tarbian's councilmen. It was met with great laughter and applause. From there, it was a short step for us to begin composing a song about Ambrose. Threp was an inveterate gossipmonger with a knack for tasteless innuendo, and I have always had a gift for a catchy tune. It took us under an hour to compose our masterwork, which we lovingly titled Jackass, Jackass. On the surface, it was a ribald little tune about a donkey who wanted to become an arcanist. Our extraordinarily clever pun on Ambrose's surname was as close as we came to mentioning him, but anyone with half a wit could tell who the shoe was meant to fit. It was late when Threp and I took the stage, and we weren't the only ones worse for drink. There was thunderous laughter and applause from the majority of the audience, who called for an encore. We gave it to them again, and everyone came in singing on the chorus. The key to the song's success was its simplicity. You could whistle or hum it. Anyone with three fingers could play it, and if you had one ear and a bucket, you could carry the tune. It was catchy, and vulgar, and mean-spirited. It spread through the university like a fire in a field. I tugged open the outer door of the archives and stepped into the entry hall, my eyes adjusting to the red tint of the sympathy lamps. The air was dry and cool, rich with the smell of dust, leather, and old ink. I took a breath the way a starving man might outside a bakery. Willem was tending the desk, I knew he'd be working. Ambrose wasn't anywhere in the building. "I'm just here to talk with Master Lauren," I said quickly. Will relaxed.
"He's with someone right now. It might be a while."
A tall, lean, Sealdish man opened the door behind the entry desk. Unlike most Sealdish men, he was clean-shaven and wore his hair long, pulled back into a tail. He wore well-mended hunter's leathers, a faded traveling cloak, and high boots, all dusty from the road. As he shut the door behind him, his hand went unconsciously to the hilt of his sword to keep it from striking the wall or the desk.
"Italia too. Yari Aiden, I see ya,"
he said in Siaru, clapping Willem on the shoulder as he walked out from behind the desk.
"Vorelan tua tatum."
Will gave a rare smile, shrugging.
"Linsatva. Tua kveren."
The man laughed, and as he stepped around the desk, I saw he wore a long knife in addition to his sword. I'd never seen anyone armed at the university. Here in the archives, he looked as out of place as a sheep in the king's court. But his manner was relaxed, confident, as if he couldn't feel more at home. He stopped walking when he saw me standing there. He cocked his head to the side a little.
"Sightseeing?"
I didn't recognize the language.
"I beg your pardon?" "Oh, sorry," he said, speaking perfect Aeturan. "You looked Yilish. The red hair fooled me."
He looked at me closer.
"But you're not, are you?
You're one of the Ru."
He stepped forward and held out his hand to me.
"One family."
I shook it without thinking. His hand was solid as a rock, and his dark Sealdish complexion was tanned even darker than usual, highlighting a few pale scars that ran over his knuckles and up his arms. "One family," I echoed, too surprised to say anything else.
"Folk from the family are a rare thing here,"
he said easily, walking past me toward the outer door.
"I'd stop and share news, but I've got to make it to Evesdown before sunset or I'll miss my ship."
He opened the outer door and sunlight flooded the room.
"I'll catch up with you when I'm back in these parts,"
he said, and with a wave, he was gone. I turned to Willem. "Who was that?"
"One of Lauren's gillers," Will said. "Viari."
"He's a scriv?" I said incredulously, thinking of the pale, quiet students who worked in the archives, sorting, scribing, and fetching books. Will shook his head.
"He works in acquisitions. They bring back books from all over the world. They're a different breed entirely."
"I gathered that," I said, glancing at the door.
"He's the one Lauren was talking to, so you can go in now,"
Will said, getting to his feet and opening the door behind the massive wooden desk.
"Down at the end of the hall, there's a brass plate on his door. I'd walk you back, but we're short-staffed. I can't leave the desk."
I nodded and began to walk down the hallway. I smiled to hear Will softly humming the melody from Jackass Jackass under his breath. Then the door gave a muffled thump behind me, and the hall was quiet save for the sound of my own breathing. By the time I reached the appropriate door, my hands were clammy with sweat. I knocked. "Enter," Lauren called from inside. His voice was like a sheet of smooth gray slate without the barest hint of inflection or emotion. I opened the door. Lauren sat behind a huge semicircular desk. Shelves lined the walls from floor to ceiling. The room was so full of books, there wasn't more than a palm's breadth of wall visible in the entire room. Lauren looked at me coolly. Even sitting down, he was still nearly as tall as me.
"Good morning."
"I know I'm banned from the archives, Master," I said quickly. "I hope that I'm not violating that by coming to see you."
"Not if you're here to good purpose."
"I've come into some money," I said, pulling out my purse, "and I was hoping to buy back my copy of Rhetoric and Logic." Lauren nodded and came to his feet. Tall, clean-shaven, and wearing his dark master's robes, he reminded me of the enigmatic Silent Doctor character present in many Modagan plays. I fought off a shiver, trying not to dwell on the fact that the appearance of the doctor always signaled catastrophe in the next act.
Lauren went to one of the shelves and pulled out a small book. Even at a glimpse, I recognized it as mine. A dark stain patterned the cover from the time it had gotten wet during a storm in Tarbian. I fumbled with the strings of my purse, surprised to see my hands trembling slightly. "It was 2 silver pennies, I believe." Lauren nodded. "Can I offer you anything in addition to that? If you hadn't bought it for me, I would have lost it forever, not to mention the fact that your purchase helped me gain admittance in the first place."
2 silver pennies will be sufficient.
I lay the coins on his desk. They clattered slightly as I set them down, testament to my shaking hands. Lauren held out the book, and I wiped my sweaty hands on my shirt before taking it. I opened it to Ben's inscription and smiled. "Thank you for taking care of it, Master Lauren. It is precious to me."
"The care of one more book is little trouble," Lauren said as he returned to his seat.
I waited to see if he might continue. He didn't. My voice snagged in my throat. I swallowed to clear it. "I also wanted to say that I was sorry for..." I stalled at the thought of actually mentioning Open Flame in the archives. "For what I did before," I finished lamely.
"I accept your apology, Quoth."
Lauren looked back down at the book he had been reading when I had come in.
"Good morning."
I swallowed again against the dryness in my mouth. I was also wondering when I might hope to regain admittance to the archives. Lauren looked up at me.
"You were caught with live fire among my books," he said, emotion touching the edges of his voice like a hint of red sunset against the slate-gray clouds.
All of my carefully planned persuasion flew out of my head. "Master Lauren," I pleaded, "I'd been whipped that day and wasn't at my wit's best. Ambrose..." Lauren raised his long-fingered hand from the desk, his palm facing out toward me. The careful gesture cut me off more quickly than a slap across the face. His face was expressionless as a blank page.
"Who am I to believe? A Relar of 3 years or an Elir of 2 months? A scriv in my employ or an unfamiliar student found guilty of reckless use of sympathy?"
I managed to regain a little of my composure. "I understand your decision, Master Lauren, but is there anything I might do to earn readmittance?" I asked, unable to keep my voice entirely free of desperation. "Honestly, I would rather be whipped again than spend another term banned. I would give you all the money in my pocket, though it isn't much. I'd work long hours as a scriv, without pay, for the privilege of proving myself to you. I know you're short-staffed during exams." Lauren looked at me, his placid eyes almost curious. I couldn't help but feel that my plea had affected him.
"All that?"
"All that," I said earnestly, hope billowing wildly through my chest. "All that, and any other penance you desire."
"I require but one thing to rescind my ban," Lauren said.
I fought to keep a manic grin off my face.
"Anything!"
"Demonstrate the patience and prudence which you have heretofore been lacking," Lauren said flatly, then looked down at the book that lay open on his desk.
"Good morning."
The next day, one of Jameson's errand boys woke me out of a sound sleep in my vast bed at the Horse and Four. He informed me that I was due on the Horns at 15 minutes before noon. I was being charged with conduct unbecoming a member of the Arcanum. Ambrose had finally caught wind of my song. I spent the next several hours feeling vaguely sick to my stomach. This was exactly what I'd hoped to avoid. An opportunity for both Ambrose and Hem to settle scores with me. Worse still, this was bound to lower Lauren's opinion of me even further, no matter what the outcome. I arrived in the Master's Hall early and was relieved to find the atmosphere much more relaxed than when I'd gone on the Horns for malfeasance against Hem. Arwill and Elxadal smiled at me. Kilvin nodded. I was relieved that I had friends among the Masters to balance out the enemies I'd made.
"All right," the Chancellor said briskly. "We've got 10 minutes before we start admissions.
I don't feel like getting behind schedule, so I'm going to move this right along. He looked around at the rest of the masters and saw only nods. Raylar Ambrose, make your case. Keep it under a minute. You have a copy of the song right there, Ambrose said hotly. It's slanderous. It defames my good name. It's a shameful way for a member of the Arcanum to behave. He swallowed, his jaw clenching. That's all. The Chancellor turned to me. Anything to say in your defense? It was in poor taste, Chancellor, but I didn't expect it to get around. I only sang it on one occasion, in fact. Fair enough. The Chancellor looked down at the paper in front of him. He cleared his throat. Raylar Ambrose, are you a donkey? Ambrose went stiff. No, sir, he said. Are you possessed of... He cleared his throat and read directly off the page. A pizzle bound to fizzle? A few of the masters struggled to control smiles. Elodin grinned openly. Ambrose flushed. No, sir. Then I'm afraid I don't see the problem, the Chancellor said curtly, letting the paper settle to the table. I move the charge of conduct unbecoming be replaced with undignified mischief.
Seconded,
Kilvin said. All in favor? All hands went up except for Hems and Brandur's. Motion passed. Discipline will be set at a formal letter of apology tendered to...
For God's sake, Arthur, Hem broke in, at least make it a public letter.
The Chancellor glared at Hem, then shrugged. Formal letter of apology posted publicly before the fall term. All in favor? All hands were raised. Motion passed. The Chancellor leaned forward onto his elbows and looked down at Ambrose. Raylar Ambrose, in the future you will refrain from wasting our time with spurious charges. I could feel the anger radiating off Ambrose. It was like standing near a fire.
Yes, sir.
Before I could feel smug, the Chancellor turned to me. And you, Elir Kvoth, will comport yourself with more decorum in the future. His stern words were somewhat spoiled by the fact that Elodin had begun cheerfully humming the melody to Jackass Jackass next to him. I lowered my eyes and did my best to fight down a smile.
Yes, sir.
Dismissed. Ambrose turned on his heels and stormed off, but before he made it through the door, Elodin burst out singing. He's a well-bred ass, you can see it in his stride, and for a copper penny he will let you take a ride. The thought of writing a public apology was galling to me. But, as they say, the best revenge is living well. So I decided to ignore Ambrose and enjoy my new luxurious lifestyle at the Horse and Four. But I only managed 2 days of revenge. On the third day, the Horse and Four had a new owner. Short, jolly Caverin was replaced with a tall, thin man who informed me that my services were no longer required. I was told to vacate my rooms before nightfall. It was irritating, but I knew of at least 4 or 5 inns of similar quality on this side of the river that would jump at the chance to employ a musician with his talent pipes. But the innkeeper at Hollybush refused to speak with me. The White Hart and Queen's Crown were content with their current musicians. At the Golden Pony, I waited for over an hour before I realized I was being politely ignored. By the time I was turned away by the Royal Oak, I was fuming. It was Ambrose. I didn't know how he'd done it, but I knew it was him. Bribes, perhaps, or a rumor that any inn employing a certain red-haired musician would be losing the business of a large number of wealthy, noble customers. So I began working my way through the rest of the inns this side of the river. I'd already been turned away by the upper-class ones, but there were many respectable places left. Over the next several hours, I tried the Shepherd's Rest, the Boar's Head, Dog in the Wall, Staves Inn, and the Tabard. Ambrose had been very thorough. None of them were interested. It was early evening by the time I came to Anchors, and by that time, the only thing keeping me going was pure black temper. I was determined to try every single inn on this side of the river before I resorted to paying for a bunk and a meal chit again. When I came to the inn,
Anchor himself was up on a ladder nailing a long piece of cedar siding back into place. He looked down at me as I came to stand near the foot of the ladder.
"So you're the one," he said.
"Beg your pardon?" I said, puzzled.
"Fellow stopped by and told me that hiring a young red-haired fellow would make for a great pile of unpleasantness."
He nodded at my loot.
"You must be him."
"Well, then," I said, adjusting the shoulder strap of my loot case, "I won't waste your time."
"You aren't wasting it yet,"
he said as he climbed down the ladder, wiping his hands on his shirt.
"The place could use some music."
I gave him a searching look. "Aren't you worried?" He spat.
"Damn little gadflies think they can buy the sun out of the sky, don't they?"
"This particular one could probably afford it," I said grimly. "And the moon, too, if he wanted the match set to use as bookends." He snorted derisively.
"He can't do a damn thing to me. I don't cater to his sort of folk, so he can't scare off my business. And I own this place my own self, so he can't buy it and fire me off like he did to poor old Caveran."
"Someone bought the horse and four?" Anchor gave me a speculative look.
"You didn't know?"
I shook my head slowly, taking a moment to digest this piece of information. Ambrose had bought the horse and four just to spite me out of a job. No, he was too clever for that. He had probably loaned the money to a friend and passed it off as a business venture. How much had it cost? 1,000 talents? 5,000? I couldn't even guess how much an inn like the Horse and Four was worth. What was even more disturbing was how quickly he had managed it. It put things in sharp perspective for me. I'd known Ambrose was rich, but honestly, everyone was rich compared to me. I'd never bothered thinking about how wealthy he was, or how he could use it against me. I was getting a lesson in the sort of influence a wealthy baron's firstborn son could bring to bear. For the first time, I was glad for the university's strict code of conduct. If Ambrose was willing to go to these lengths, I could only imagine what drastic measures he would take if he didn't need to maintain a semblance of civility. I was jolted out of my reverie by a young woman leaning out the front door of the inn.
"Damn you, Anchor!" she shouted. "I'm not going to pull and carry while you stand out here scratching your arse! Get in here!"
Anchor muttered something under his breath as he picked up the ladder and he stowed it around the corner in the alleyway.
"What'd you do to this fellow anyway? Chop his mum?"
"Wrote a song about him, actually." As Anchor opened the door of the inn, a gentle welter of conversation poured out onto the street.
"I'd be curious to hear a song like that," he grinned. "Why don't you come give it a play?"
"If you're sure," I said, not quite believing my luck. "There's bound to be trouble."
"Trouble?" he chuckled. "What does a boy like you know about trouble? I was in trouble afore you were born. I've been in trouble you don't even got words for."
He turned to face me, still standing in the doorway.
"It's been a while since we've had music in here regular. Can't say as I like to go without. A proper tavern has music."
I smiled. "I have to agree with you there."
"Truth is, I'd have you in just to twist that rich tit's nose," Anchor said. "But if you can play worth half a damn—"
He pushed the door open farther, making it an invitation. I could smell sawdust and honest sweat and baking bread. By the end of the night, it was all arranged. In exchange for playing four nights a span, I earned a tiny room on the third floor and the assurance that if I was around at mealtimes, I would be welcome to a bit of whatever was cooking in the pot. Admittedly, Anchor was getting the services of a talented musician for a bargain price, but it was a deal I was happy to make. Anything was better than going back to the muse and the silent scorn of my bunkmates. The ceiling of my tiny room slanted downward in two corners, making it seem even smaller than it really was. It would have been cluttered if there had been more than the few sticks of furniture, a small desk with a wooden chair and a single shelf above it. The bed was flat and narrow as any bunk in the mews. I set my slightly battered copy of Rhetoric and Logic on the shelf over the desk. My loot case leaned comfortably in the corner. Through the window, I could see the lights of the university unblinking in the cool autumn air. I was home. Looking back, I count myself lucky that I ended up in Anchors. True, the crowds were not as wealthy as those at the Horse and Four, but they appreciated me in a way the nobles never had. And while my suite of rooms at the Horse and Four had been luxurious, my tiny room at Anchors was comfortable. Think in terms of shoes. You don't want the biggest you can find. You want the pair that fits. In time, that tiny room at Anchors came to be more of a home to me than anywhere else in the world. But at that particular moment, I was furious at what Ambrose had cost me. So when I sat down to write my public letter of apology, it dripped with venomous sincerity. It was a work of art. I beat my breast with remorse. I wailed and gnashed my teeth over the fact that I had maligned a fellow student. I also included a full copy of the lyrics, along with two new verses and full musical notation. I then apologized in excruciating detail about every vulgar, petty innuendo included in the song. I then spent 4 precious jots of my own money on paper and ink and called in the favor Jackson owed me for trading him my late admission slot. He had a friend that worked in a print shop, and with his help, we printed over 100 copies of the letter. Then, the night before fall term began, Will, Sim, and I posted them on every flat surface we could find on both sides of the river. We used a lovely alchemical adhesive Simon had cooked up for the occasion. The stuff went on like paint, then dried clear as glass and hard as steel. If anyone wanted to remove the posts, they'd need a hammer and chisel. In hindsight, it was as foolish as taunting an angry bull, and if I had to guess, I'd say this particular piece of insolence was the main reason Ambrose eventually tried to kill me. Chapter 62. Leaves. Under pointed advice from several sources, I limited myself to 3 fields of study in the upcoming term. I continued advanced sympathy with Alxadal, held a shift in the Medica, and continued my apprenticeship under Manette. My time was pleasantly full, but not overburdened as it had been last term. I studied my artificing more doggedly than anything else. Since my search for a patron had come to a dead end, I knew my best chance for self-sufficiency lay in becoming an artificer. Currently, I worked for Kilvin and was given relatively menial jobs at relatively low pay. Once I finished my apprenticeship, that would improve. Better still, I would be able to pursue my own projects, then sell them on commission for a profit. If I was able to keep ahead of my debt to Devi, if I could somehow continue to muster enough money for tuition, if I could finish my apprenticeship under Manette without getting myself killed or crippled by the dangerous work that was done in the fishery every day. 40 or 50 of us gathered in the workshop, waiting to see the new arrival. Some sat on the stone work tables to get a good view, while a dozen or so students gathered on the iron catwalks in the rafters among Kilvin's hanging lamps. I saw Manette up there. He was hard to miss. 3 times older than any of the other students, with his wild hair and grizzled beard. I headed up the stairs and made my way to his side. He smiled and clapped me on the shoulder. "What are you doing here?" I asked. "I thought this was just for the Greenwood who haven't seen this stuff before."
"I thought I'd play the dutiful mentor today," he shrugged. "Besides, this particular display is worth watching, if only for the expression on everyone's faces."
Sitting atop one of the shop's heavy work tables was a massive cylindrical container about 4 feet high and 2 feet across. The edges were sealed without any bulky welds, and the metal had a dull, burnished look that made me guess it was more than simple steel. I let my gaze wander the room and was surprised to see Fella standing in the crowd, waiting for the demonstration to begin along with the rest of the students. "I didn't know Fella worked here," I said to Manette. Manette nodded.
"Oh, sure. What, 2 terms now?"
"I'm surprised I haven't noticed," I mused as I watched her talking to one of the other women in the crowd.
"So am I," Manette said with a low, knowing chuckle. "But she's not here very often. She sculpts and works with cut tile and glass. She's here for the equipment, not the sigildry."
The belling tower struck the hour outside, and Kilvin looked around, marking the faces of everyone there. I didn't doubt for a moment that he took note of exactly who was missing.
"For several span we will have this in the shop,"
he said simply, gesturing to the metal container that stood nearby.
"Nearly 10 gallons of a volatile transporting agent, Regum Ignal Neratum."
"He's the only one that calls it that," Manette said softly. "It's bone tar." "Bone tar?" He nodded.
"It's caustic. Spill it on your arm, it'll eat through to the bone in about 10 seconds.
While everyone watched, Kilvin donned a thick leather glove and decanted about an ounce of dark liquid from the metal canister into a glass vial.
"It is important to chill the vial prior to decanting, as the agent boils at room temperature."
He quickly sealed off the vial and held it up for everyone to see.
"The pressure cap is also essential, as the liquid is extremely volatile. As a gas, it exhibits surface tension and viscosity like mercury. It is heavier than air and does not dissipate. It coheres to itself."
With no further preamble, Kilvin tossed the vial into a nearby firewell, and there was the sharp, clear sound of breaking glass. From this height, I could see the firewell must have been cleaned out specially for this occasion. It was empty, just a shallow, circular pit of bare stone.
"It's a shame he's not more of a showman," Manette said softly to me. "Elxadal could do this with a little more flair."
The room was filled with a sharp crackling and hissing as the dark liquid warmed itself against the stone of the firewall and began to boil. From my high vantage, I could see a thick, oily smoke slowly filling the bottom of the well. It didn't behave like fog or smoke at all. Its edges didn't diffuse. It pooled and hung together like a tiny, dark cloud. Manette tapped me on the shoulder, and I looked at him just in time to avoid being blinded by the initial burst of flame as the cloud caught fire. There were dismayed noises from all around, and I guessed most of the others had been caught unaware. Manette grinned at me and gave a knowing wink. "Thanks," I said, and turned back to watch. Jagged flames danced across the surface of the fog, colored a bright sodium red. The additional heat made the dark fog boil faster, and it swelled until the flames were licking toward the top of the waist-high lip of the firewall. Even from where I stood on the catwalk, I could feel a gentle heat on my face. "What the hell do you call that?" I asked him quietly.
"Fire fog?"
"We could," he responded.
"Kilvin would probably call it an atmospherically activated incendiary action."
The fire flickered and died all at once, leaving the room filled with the acrid smell of hot stone.
"In addition to being highly corrosive," Kilvin said, "in its gaseous state, the reagent is flammable. Once it warms sufficiently, it will burn on contact with air. The heat that this produces can cause a cascading exothermic reaction."
"Cascading huge goddamn fire," Manette said.
"You're better than a chorus," I said softly, trying to keep a straight face. Kilvin gestured.
"This container is designed to keep the agent cold and under pressure. Be mindful while it remains in the workshop. Avoid excessive heat in its immediate vicinity."
With that, Kilvin turned and headed back into his office.
"That's it?"
I asked. Manette shrugged.
"What else needs to be said? Kilvin doesn't let anyone work here unless they're careful, and now everyone knows what to be careful of."
"Why is it even here?" I asked. "What's it good for?"
"Scares the hell out of the first-termers," he grinned.
"Anything more practical than that?"
"Fear is plenty practical," he said. "But you can use it to make a different type of emitter for sympathy lamps. You get a bluish light instead of the ordinary red. A little easier on the eyes. Fetch outrageous prices."
I looked down into the workshop, but couldn't see Fella anywhere in the milling bodies. I turned back to Manette. "Want to keep playing dutiful mentor and show me how?" He absently ran his hands through his wild hair and shrugged.
"Sure."
I was playing at Anchor's later that night when I caught the eye of a beautiful girl sitting at one of the crowded tables in back. She looked remarkably like Denna, but I knew that to be nothing more than my own fancy. I hoped to see her enough that I had been catching glimpses of her out of the corner of my eye for days. My second glance told me the truth. It was Denna, singing along with half the folk in Anchor's to Drover's Daughters. She saw I was looking in her direction and waved.
Her appearance caught me so much by surprise that I completely forgot what my fingers were doing, and my song fell to pieces. Everyone laughed, and I took a grand bow to hide my embarrassment. They cheered and booed me in equal amounts for a minute or so, enjoying my failure more than they had the song itself. Such is human nature. I waited for their attention to drift away from me, then made my way casually to where Denna was sitting. She stood to greet me.
"I'd heard you were playing on this side of the river," she said, "but I can't imagine how you keep the job if you fall apart every time a girl gives you a wink."
I felt myself flush a little. "It doesn't happen that often."
"The winking or the falling apart?"
Unable to think of a response, I felt myself flush redder, and she laughed.
"How long will you be playing tonight?"
she asked. "Not much longer," I lied. I owed anchor at least another hour. She brightened.
"Good. Come away with me afterward. I need someone to walk with."
Hardly believing my good luck, I made a bow to her.
"At your service, certainly. Let me go and finish up."
I made my way to the bar where Anchor and two of his serving girls were busy pulling drinks. Unable to catch his eye, I grabbed hold of his apron as he hurried past me. He jerked to a stop and barely avoided spilling a tray of drinks onto a table of customers.
"God's teeth, boy! What's the matter with you?"
"Anchor, I've got to go. I can't stay till closing tonight." His face soured.
"Crowds like this don't come for the asking. They ain't going to stay without a little song or summat to entertain 'em."
"I'll do one more song, a long one, but I've got to go after that." I gave him a desperate look. "I swear I'll make it up to you." He looked at me more closely.
"Are ye in trouble?"
I shook my head.
"It's a girl, then."
He turned his head at the sound of voices calling for more drinks, then waved me away briskly.
"Fine, go. But mind you, make it a good long song, and you'll owe me."
I moved to the front of the room and clapped my hands for the room's attention. Once the room was moderately quiet, I began to play. By the time I struck the third chord, everyone knew what it was. Tinker Tanner, the oldest song in the world. I took my hands from the lute and began to clap. Soon everyone was pounding out the rhythm in unison, feet against the floor, mugs on tabletops. The sound was almost overwhelming, but it faded appropriately when I sang the first verse. Then I led the room in the chorus with everyone singing along, some with their own words, some in their own keys. I moved to a nearby table as I finished my second verse and led the room in the chorus again. Then I gestured expectantly toward the table to sing a verse of their own. It took a couple of seconds for them to realize what I wanted, but the expectation of the whole room was enough to encourage one of the more tipsy students to shout out a verse of his own. It gained him thunderous applause and cheers. Then, as everyone sang the chorus again, I moved to another table and did the same thing. Before too long, folk were taking initiative to sing out their own verses when the chorus was over. I made my way to where Denna waited by the outer door, and together we slipped out into the early evening twilight.
"That was cleverly done," she said as we began to stroll away from the tavern. "How long do you think they'll keep it up?"
"That will all depend on how quickly Anchor manages to pull down drinks for the lot of them." I came to a stop at the edge of the alley and ran between the back of Anchor's tavern and the bakery next door. "If you'll excuse me a moment, I have to put my loot away."
"In an alley?"
she asked.
"In my room."
Stepping lightly, I moved quickly up the side of the building. Right foot rain barrel, left foot window ledge, left hand iron drain pipe, and I swung myself onto the lip of the first story roof. I hopped across the alley to the roof of the bakery and smiled at her startled intake of breath. From there, it was a short stroll upward, and I hopped back across to the second-story roof of Anchor's. Tripping the latch to my window, I reached through and set my loot lightly on my bed before heading back down the way I had come.
"Does Anchor charge a penny every time you use his stairs?" she asked as I neared the ground.
I stepped down from the rain barrel and brushed my hands against my pants.
"I come and go at odd hours," I explained easily as I fell into step beside her.
"Am I correct in understanding that you are looking for a gentleman to walk with you tonight?"
A smile curved her lips as she looked sideways at me. Quite. That is unfortunate, I sighed. I am no gentleman. Her smile grew. I think that you are close enough. I would like to be closer. Then come walking with me. It would please me greatly. However, I slowed my walk a bit, my smile fading into a more serious expression. What about Savoy? Her mouth made a line. He staked a claim on me, then? Well, not as such, but there are certain protocols involved. A gentleman's agreement? She asked acidly. More like honor among thieves, if you will. She looked me in the eye. Quoth, she said seriously, steal me. I bowed and made a sweeping gesture toward the world. At your command. We continued our walk. The moon was shining, making the houses and shops around us seem washed and pale. How is Savoy, anyway? I haven't seen him for a while. She waved a hand to dismiss the thought of him. I haven't either, not for lack of trying on his part. My spirits rose a bit.
Really?
She rolled her eyes. Roses! I swear, you men have all your romance from the same worn book. Flowers are a good thing, a sweet thing to give a lady. But it's always roses, always red, and always perfect hothouse blooms when they can come by them. She turned to face me. When you see me, do you think of roses? I knew enough to shake my head, smiling. What then? If not a rose, what do you see? Trapped. I looked her up and down once, as if trying to decide. Well, I said slowly, you'll have to forgive us men. You see, it's not an easy thing to pick a flower to fit a girl, if you'll excuse my expression. She grimaced. Pick a flower? Yes, I'll excuse it this time. The trouble is, when you gift a girl with flowers, your choice can be construed so many different ways. A man might give you a rose because he feels you are beautiful, or because he fancies their shade or shape or softness similar to your lips. Roses are expensive, and perhaps he wishes to show through a valuable gift that you are valuable to him. You make a good case for roses, she said. The fact remains, I do not like them. Pick another flower to suit me. But what suits? When a man gives you a rose, what you see may not be what he intends. You may think he sees you as delicate or frail. Perhaps you dislike a suitor who considers you all sweet and nothing else. Perhaps the stem is thorned, and you assume he thinks you likely to hurt a hand too quick to touch. But if he trims the thorns, you might think he has no liking for a thing that can defend itself with sharpness. There's so many ways a thing can be interpreted, I said. What is a careful man to do? She cast a sidelong look at me. If the man is you, I'd guess he would spin clever words and hope the question was forgotten. She tilted her head. It isn't. What flower would you pick for me? Very well. Let me think. I turned to look at her, then away. Let's run down a list. Dandelion might be good. It's bright, and there is a brightness about you. But dandelion is common, and you are not a common creature. Roses we have dealt with and discarded. Nightshade, no. Nettle, perhaps. She made a face of mock outrage and showed me her tongue. I tapped a finger to my lips as if reconsidering. You are correct, except for your tongue, it doesn't suit you. She huffed and crossed her arms. Wild oat! I exclaimed, startling a laugh from her. Its wildness suits you, but it's a small flower and bashful. For that as well as other, I cleared my throat, more obvious reasons, I think we'll pass the wild oat by. Pity. She said. Daisy is a good one. I bowled ahead, not letting her distract me. Tall and slender, willing to grow by roadsides, a hardy flower, not too delicate. Daisy is self-reliant. I think it might suit you, but let us continue in our list. Iris? Too gaudy. Thistle? Too distant. Violet? Too brief. Trillium? There's a thing. A fair flower. Doesn't take to cultivation. The texture of the petals. I made the boldest motion of my young life and brushed the side of her neck gently with a pair of fingers. Smooth enough to match your skin, just barely. But it is too close to the ground. This is quite a bouquet you've brought for me, she said gently. Unconsciously, she raised a hand to the side of her neck where I had touched her, held it there for a moment, then let it fall. A good sign or a bad one? Was she wiping my touch away or pressing it close? Uncertainty filled me more strongly than before, and I decided to press ahead with no more blatant risks. I stopped walking. Celis flower. She stopped and turned to look at me. All this, and you pick a flower I don't know? What is a celis flower? Why? It is a deep red flower that grows on a strong vine. Its leaves are dark and delicate. They grow best in shadowy places, but the flower itself finds stray sunbeams to bloom in. I looked at her. That suits you. There is much of you that is both shadow and light. It grows in deep forests and is rare because only skilled folk can tend one without harming it. It has a wondrous smell and is much sought and seldom found. I paused and made a point of examining her. Yes. Since I'm forced to pick, I would choose Celis. She looked at me, looked away. You think too much of me. I smiled. Perhaps you think too little of yourself. She caught a piece of my smile and shone it back at me. You were closer earlier in your list. Daisies, simple and sweet. Daisies are the way to win my heart. I will remember it. We started walking again. What flower would you bring me? I teased, thinking to catch her off guard. A willow blossom, she said without a second's hesitation. I thought for a long minute. Do willows have blossoms? She looked up and to the side, thinking. I don't think so. A rare treat to be given one, then, I chuckled. Why a willow blossom? You remind me of a willow, she said easily. Strong, deep-rooted, and hidden. You move easily when the storm comes, but never farther than you wish. I lifted my hands as if fending off a blow. Cease these sweet words, I protested. You seek to bend me to your will, but it will not work. Your flattery is naught to me but wind. She watched me for a moment, as if to make sure my tirade was complete. Beyond all other trees, she said with a curl of a smile on her elegant mouth, the willow moves to the wind's desire. The stars told me 5 hours had passed, but it seemed hardly any time at all before we came to the oaken oar where she was staying in Imre. At the doorway, there was a moment that lasted for an hour as I considered kissing her. I had been tempted by the thought 12 times on the road as we talked. When we paused on Stonebridge to watch the river in the moonlight, underneath a linden tree in one of Imre's parks. At those times, I felt a tension building between us, something almost tangible. When she looked sideways at me with her secret smile, the tilt of her head, the way she almost faced me, made me think she must be hoping for me to do something. Put my arm around her? Kiss her? How did one know? How could I be certain? I couldn't. So I resisted the pull of her. I did not want to presume too much, did not want to offend her or embarrass myself. What's more, Diok's warning had made me uncertain. Perhaps what I felt was nothing more than Denna's natural charm, her charisma. Like all boys of my age, I was an idiot when it came to women. The difference between me and the others is that I was painfully aware of my ignorance,
while others, like Simon, bumbled around, making asses of themselves with their clumsy courting. I could think of nothing worse than making some unwelcome advance toward Denna and having her laugh at the awkwardness of my attempt. I hate nothing more than doing things badly. So, I made my goodbyes and watched her enter the side door of the Oaken Oar. I took a deep breath and could hardly keep from laughing or dancing about. I was so full of her. The smell of the wind through her hair, the sound of her voice, the way the moonlight cast shadows across her face. Then, slowly, my feet settled to the ground. Before I had taken 6 steps, I sagged like a sail when the wind fades. As I walked back through the town, past sleeping houses and dark inns, my mood swung from elation to doubt in the space of 3 brief breaths. I had ruined everything. All the things I had said, things that seemed so clever at the time, were in fact the worst things a fool could say. Even now she was inside, breathing a sigh of relief to finally be rid of me. But she had smiled, had laughed. She hadn't remembered our first meeting on the road from Tarbian. I couldn't have made that much of an impression on her. "Steal me," she had said. I should have been bolder and kissed her at the end. I should have been more cautious. I had talked too much. I had said too little. Chapter 63. Walking and Talking. Willem and Simon were already well into their lunches when I arrived at our usual spot in the courtyard. "Sorry," I said as I set my loot on the cobblestones near the bench. "Got caught up haggling." I had been on the other side of the river buying a dram of quicksilver and a pouch of sea salt. The last had cost me dearly, but for once I wasn't concerned about money. If fortune smiled on me, I would be moving up the ranks in the fishery soon, and that meant my money troubles would soon be over. While shopping in Imre, I had also, quite by coincidence, wandered past the inn where Denna was staying. But she hadn't been there, or at the Aeolian, or in the park where we'd stopped to talk last night. All the same, I was in a fine mood. I tipped my loot case onto its side and flipped it open so the sun could warm the new strings, helping them stretch. Then I settled onto the stone bench under the pennant pole next to my 2 friends. "So, where were you last night?" Simon asked too casually. It was only then I remembered that the 3 of us had planned to meet up with Fenton and play corners last night. Seeing Denna had completely driven the plan from my mind. "Oh, God, I'm sorry, Sim. How long did you wait for me?" He gave me a look. "I'm sorry," I repeated, hoping I looked as guilty as I felt. "I forgot." Sim grinned, shrugging it off. "It's not a big deal. When we figured out you weren't going to show, we went to the library to drink and look at girls." "Was Fenton mad?"
"Furious," Willem said calmly, finally entering the conversation. "Said he was going to box your ears next time he saw you."
Sim's grin widened. He called you a fluff-headed Elir with no respect for his betters.
"Made claims about your parentage and sexual tendency toward animals," Willem said with a straight face.
"In the Talon's cassock," Simon sang with his mouth full. Then he laughed and started to choke. I pounded him on the back.
"Where were you?" Willem asked while Sim tried to get his breath back. "Anchor said you left early."
For some reason, I found myself reluctant to talk about Denna. I met someone.
"Someone more important than us?" Willem asked in a flat tone that could be taken for dry humor or criticism.
"A girl," I admitted. One of his eyebrows went up.
"The one you've been chasing around?"
"I haven't been chasing anyone," I protested. "She found me at Anchor's."
"Good sign," Willem said.
Simon nodded wisely, then looked up with a playful glint in his eye.
"So, did you make any music?"
He nudged me with an elbow and wagged his eyebrows up and down. "A little duet?" He looked too ridiculous for me to be offended. "No music. She just wanted someone to walk her home."
"Walk her home?"
he said suggestively, wagging his eyebrows again.
I found it less amusing this time. "It was dark out," I said seriously. "I just escorted her back to Imre."
"Oh," Sim said disappointed.
"You left Anchors early," Will said slowly, "and we waited for an hour. Does it take you 2 hours to walk to Imre and back?"
"It was a long walk," I admitted. "How long is long?" Simon asked.
"A few hours." I looked away.
"Six."
"6 hours?" Sim asked.
"Come on. I think I'm entitled to a few details after listening to you ramble on about her for the last 2 span. I began to bristle. "I don't ramble. We just walked," I said.
"Talked."
Sim looked doubtful.
"Oh, come on. For 6 hours?
Willem tapped Simon's shoulder.
"He's telling the truth."
Simon glanced over at him. "Why do you say that?"
"He sounds more sincere than that when he lies."
"If the two of you will be quiet for a minute or so, I'll tell you the whole of it. Fair?" They nodded. I looked down at my hands, trying to collect my thoughts, but they wouldn't fall into any sort of orderly pattern. We took the long way back to Imre, stopped on Stonebridge for a while. Went to a park outside town, sat by the river. We talked about nothing, really. Places we've been, songs. I realized I was rambling and shut my mouth. I picked my next words carefully. I thought about doing more than walking and talking, but I stopped. I had no idea what to say. They were both silent for a moment.
"I'll be," Willem marveled. "The mighty Quoth brought low by a woman."
"If I didn't know you, I'd think you were scared," Simon said, not quite seriously.
"You're damn right I'm scared," I said in a low voice, wiping my hands nervously against my pants.
"You'd be too if you'd ever met her. It's all I can do to sit here instead of running off to Imre, hoping to see her through a store window or pass her crossing the street." I gave a shaky smile.
"Go then,"
Simon smiled and gave me a little push. "Godspeed.
If I knew a woman like that, I wouldn't be here eating lunch with the likes of you two."
He brushed his hair away from his eyes and gave me another push with his free hand.
"Go on."
I stayed where I was.
"It's not that easy."
"Nothing's ever easy with you," Willem muttered.
"Of course it's that easy," Simon laughed. "Go tell her some of what you just told us."
"Right," I said with dark sarcasm, as if it were simple as singing. "Besides, I don't know if she would want to hear it. She's something special. What would she want with me?"
Simon gave me a frank stare.
"She came looking for you. She obviously wants something." There was a moment of silence, and I hurried to change the subject while I had the chance. "Manette's given me permission to start my journeyman project."
"Already?"
Sim gave me an anxious look.
"Will Kilvin go along with it? He's not a big one for cutting corners."
"I didn't cut any corners," I said. "I just pick things up quickly." Willem gave an amused snort, and Sim spoke up before the two of us started to bicker.
"What are you doing for your project? Sympathy lamp?"
"Everyone does a lamp," Willem said.
I nodded. "I want to do something different. Maybe a Gearwin, but Manette told me to stick to the lamp." The belling tower struck 4. I got to my feet and gathered up my loot case, ready to head to class.
"You should tell her," Simon said. "If you like a girl, you have to let her know."
"How's that working out for you so far?" I said, irritated that Sim, of all people, would presume to give me relationship advice. "Statistically speaking, how often has that strategy paid off, in your vast experience?" Willem made a point of looking elsewhere while Sim and I glared at each other. I looked away first, feeling guilty.
"Besides, there's nothing to tell," I muttered. "I like spending time with her, and now I know where she's staying. That means I can find her when I go looking."